I'm Evan Kleiman, and this is Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. Today, chocolate goes spicy, fruity, and everything in between. Russ Parsons gets me all choked up over the beautiful artichoke. The truth about H.R. 875, a bill that's rumored to punish farmers' markets, plus how to eat on $30 a week. But first, let's see what's in season at the legendary Santa Monica Farmers Market.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. It's time to plant your garden, and it's also time to think about pest control. One of the experts on natural pest control is Tom Peltier, who is known as the bug guy. Tom, you're here now. You've got your arsenal of bugs. Can you tell us what we can use to prevent pests from eating all our plants?
Well, I just had a gentleman up here, and he put the decollete snails in. 6 years ago, he hasn't seen one snail since he put these in. The decollete snails, these killer snails, are carnivores. They eat the garden snails. They also eliminate the eggs of the snail. Every snail lays 2,000 eggs underground. That's the big problem. That's why poisons don't work. You got to get rid of the eggs before you get rid of the snails.
So the snails, the slimy snails with a shell that crawl around and leave slime trails everywhere that devastate a lot of gardens, they stay on top of the ground, and if you kill them, they've already laid their 2,000 eggs underground,
exactly.
And they just hatch and just keep coming.
They just keep coming, and all snails live underground, but the ones we're talking about, snails and slugs that eat your plants, they have to come up above the ground to feast.
Now, your decollete snails, they're kind of a little spiral. They don't look like the garden snail. They look more like a seashell. Mm-hmm. And they don't eat the adult snail. They eat the eggs, right?
They eat the eggs, the babies, and the medium-sized snails.
Okay, Tom. And then tell us again our favorite little critter, the ladybugs. You have those, too.
Oh, yes. Everybody loves ladybugs. And this is aphid season right now. And this is when they're... I've had a lot of calls this morning getting their ladybugs, and everybody loves ladybugs.
So you sell them in a little plastic container. You take them home. How do you get them to stick around and stay on your plant?
Well, I give you some ladybug food, first of all, and then you put them out after sundown. Then I give you information how to keep them there longer. And one of the little tricks, too, that we can play on them is you put them in a paper bag and you spritz them with soda pop. It makes their wings sticky, doesn't harm them. But in about a week or 10 days, it wears off and they fly off. But at least they're there for a good week or so.
So it's long enough for them to lay their eggs and then eat a few aphids and start the cycle.
Eat a lot of aphids, right. And that's what you want them to do is lay their eggs, because the larva is the most important part. That eats 3 to 4 times more than ladybugs can eat.
All right, Tom. So you're here all year round at the market, but now is a really great time to start putting these bugs out in your garden.
This is when people are planting. This is the most crucial time, especially for the snails, because this is when the eggs are hatching. So this is when you want to really get busy and take care of these problems.
That was Tom Peltier. He gives you an option for how to get rid of pests in your garden using adorable ladybugs and sneaky little decollete snails that you'll never see. One of the most often asked questions at the farmers markets at this time of year falls on David West from Clearwater Farms, and that would be, when are the morels going to be in? And David, looking at your stand today, I see a few morels. This is wonderful.
Mm-hmm, it's true. Here we are at right on the cusp of Easter, thankfully, because this is when most people want to begin using them. We have our first morels. They're very late this year. Our weather is similar to the weather really nationwide and probably globally. Very cool, very damp. Everything's behind in season. The spring goods are all coming late, but they are here in limited numbers. That will get better as the weather warms up. But for those of you out there that want them tomorrow for your Easter, by all means.
Now tell me, where do the morels come from? And you said the weather was a factor.
Well, morels are a wild mushroom. There's no cultivation of morels. There's some attempts at cultivation that have been less than successful. So we're at the mercy of Mother Nature for where they come from. The early morels, which these are, tend to come from either clear cuts, forest land that's been clear cut by the timber industry, or areas that had a fire in previous years. Part of the reason for that is morels love traumatized soil. So they love growing in a burn area, following a burn. The year or two or three following a burn, every year subsequent get less and less mushrooms. These are coming out of a clear cut. We ended up with about 20 pounds. It was a father and son team working all weekend, and these guys really know their stuff. So it's still a little early. However, a couple of warm rains and the morels will pop and we'll be thick with them.
Okay, now what do they look like and what do they taste like?
Well, they have a conical shape to them, pointy, sort of brain-looking, very unique-looking mushroom. So they're kind of crinkly-looking with a lot of crevices.
They're hollow inside?
They are a hollow-stem mushroom. They're very light. It's just one of the reasons, one of the things that drives their price is that it takes a lot of mushrooms to make a pound, and every one of those mushrooms somebody bent over, cut and picked, cleaned and put in a basket.
Mm-hmm.
So they're very light, they're very intensely flavored, almost like truffles. There's an earthy meatiness to them that's unique to morels.
They mostly use for sauces to make things taste even better?
They are just so versatile. I mean, just simply sautéed with some scrambled eggs is out of this world. Put over a grilled piece of meat or fish, you know, sautéed with a little, like a demi-glace type sauce.
Sounds fabulous. Now, you sell them, and I know you put them in a paper bag, which is good. It keeps them, you don't want to put them in a plastic bag.
No, very few things, in my opinion, do better in plastic than in paper. Mm-hmm. Most living things like to breathe.
Mm-hmm.
Mushrooms are, it's absolutely imperative that they breathe because they're giving off moisture constantly. They're like radiators. They're constantly giving up moisture. And if you seal them in something, that moisture is going to get trapped. It's going to turn to condensation, drip back down. It's going to start to, people say, oh, my mushrooms turned all mushy. I'm like, well, what happened? They said, well, we had them in a Tupperware.
Sure. And then how much are they?
Today they're $38
a pound. And that's a lot of morels. You said they're very light.
Well, that's a lot of, a pound of morels is enough to do, dinner for 10 or 12 people easily.
Right.
That 38 will be 28 in a week or two.
Right, David. Well, this is great. And you said they'll be coming more and more and more. How long will the season go?
Well, if the season runs true to form, we'll have it till about July 4th. Good and bad news about morels this year that we're a little concerned about for the morels but happy for the planet is that my pickers are telling me there's fewer and fewer clear cuts, and they think this is part of our recession, that the timber industry is not cutting the way they usually cut.
Because they're not building.
Yeah, so it's a good thing they're not cutting down the forest as much, but it's going to affect the morel crop. There will be less morels this year, but there'll be more trees.
That was David West. Clearly, here's a guy who knows all about mushrooms. Most of the mushrooms he sells at his stand are the wild mushrooms, and unique, rare, one-of-a-kind, very delicate ecosystems produce these wonderful fruits. So when they're in, be sure to go get them. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
You can take a look at what Laura Avery just talked about at kcrw.com/goodfood. Speaking of farmers markets, there are rumors swirling around the food community that a bill being introduced in Congress is set to punish the small farmers that sell at places like the farmers markets. I'll tell you about H.R. 875 and what the truth is next when Good Food continues on KCRW and KCRW.com. I can't remember the last time there were so many messages in my inbox that veered on the hysterical. But the Food Safety Modernization Act of 2009, or H.R. 875, seems to be the perfect vehicle to carry all sorts of fears. We all know that the internet is a really incredible source of valuable information, but we also know that it's peppered with hype and inaccuracies, and sometimes sorting out what's real and what's fake can be really complicated. We found plenty of both about the Food Safety Modernization Act, so we asked Tom Philpott of the online magazine Grist to join us today and make a little bit of sense out of it all. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Could you first just sort of give us a rundown of what the bill is about, H.R. 875?
Okay, well, it's a food safety bill, and it's an attempt to reckon with what a lot of us consider to be a broken food safety system. And I think there's two things it's mainly trying to reckon with. One of them is food coming in from foreign countries, like all the scandals of last year about melamine from China ending up in pet food and products like that. And then the problems this year, or in the past 6 or 8 months, regarding peanut butter and now pistachios. And so the bill is attempting to rationalize the food safety system to take care of those problems.
Because, I mean, we should say that right now, there are 15 different agencies that are responsible for food safety. There's no, like, one umbrella organization whose sole job it is to deal with food safety.
That's exactly right. It's fragmented, and it falls into several different categories. Meat issues fall under the USDA, and other food issues fall under the FDA. And so there's a lot of sort of blank spots where food safety issues fall that nobody really takes care of.
So this bill was brought forward by Congresswoman Rosa DeLauro, and her office says that it's intended to ensure the safety of food sold in supermarkets. But let's talk about what some of the fears are that are being just running wild all over the net.
Okay, well, there's a lot of crazy ideas on the internet. One of them is that it's Monsanto's dream bill. Monsanto is the largest seed company in the world, and it's the dominant supplier of genetically modified seeds, mostly corn, soy, and cotton. There's really little linking the bill to Monsanto. Now, DeLauro's husband is a Democratic pollster, and he worked for Monsanto. He worked on our project for Monsanto 10 years ago. And on the internet, that connection has been turned. I've heard people say that he's the CEO of Monsanto, that he currently works for Monsanto, and all that's insane. The legitimate fears are that the bill doesn't really pay attention to scale. And what I mean by that is, say, a small kitchen at a farm that's processing food and turning it to jam, selling it at the farmer's market, is inherently different from a giant company, say, in Georgia, that produces an incredible amount of the peanut butter that goes out into processed products in the United States. And
the bill doesn't really address differences in scale.
It doesn't really address differences in scale, although it is very important to note that there are a lot worse bills in Congress on this question. One of the key things is that if you require inspections of food production facilities and you require that the company itself pay for the inspection, that could be extremely damaging to really small processors like the farmer's market, the farmer turning grapes into jam in the kitchen.
The people that we might call artisan producers.
Yeah, artisan producers, I think there's a case to be made that we need food safety regulations for artisan producers, but they've got to be ones that they can work with. And I think that if you're making people who make very, very, very small profit margins pay for inspections, and you can really risk eliminating a lot of great small producers.
So let's go back just for a moment to talk about specific fears that are on the internet. The fact that it's going to be the end of local food, it's going to mandate the use of chemical pesticides, it's going to criminalize seed banking.
All of that is pure fantasy. The FDA, so basically it's rationalizing the FDA's procedures for handling food. And, the FDA is the Food and Drug Administration, and it would create out of the FDA a specific organization that focuses on food.
Which is a good thing. But
essentially splitting it in two. But it wouldn't take up the USDA's animal oversight. And so all the internet stuff about how it's going to force microchips in the animals and GPS and all that stuff, that's pure fantasy because it doesn't oversee animals at all.
So despite the fear that's been fomented about this bill, do you think it's a good bill?
I think it falls short, and I think it's a good start. From what I understand, it's the best bill out there right now in terms of respecting this whole scale issue and respecting the concerns of small-scale farmers. And, ironically, H.R. 875 is the bill that's bouncing around Congress that does the best. And I think that I wouldn't support it right now, but I would definitely support talking to the sponsors, and trying to make it more sort of scale, make it more friendly to small-scale farmers.
Well, Tom, you're one of our favorite bloggers on food politics. It's been really a pleasure to have you here this morning.
Thank you so much.
Read more about the bill, including a link to the actual text of H.R. 875, at kcrw.com/goodfood. You can find out more about Grist there, too. That's where my guest, Tom Philpott, is the food editor. Since Easter is tomorrow, it's a good time to look around at what's in season to cook for the holiday. Artichokes are blooming everywhere. I'll be right back with Russ Parsons from the LA Times. We get all choked up, but in a good way. That's next on Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. Although we can get artichokes nearly year-round these days, spring really is true artichoke season. I'm welcoming Russ Parsons from the LA Times for a thorny conversation.
Well, you know, artichokes are kind of intimidating.
I, being such an Italophile, instead of doing the American thing where you do some modest trimming, I come from the theory of you get rid of all the garbage in the kitchen.
Take it straight down. And you know, and the other thing is, the whole idea of artichokes, I mean, for most people, it's kind of a glorified fancy chips and dips.
Oh, totally.
You know, you steam it and you put some mayonnaise in the center. And you know, if it's good mayonnaise, that's a nice dish. But there's so much more to it than that. I mean, an artichoke is, it's pregnant with possibilities.
Oh, I love that. Okay, so give me some.
And the other best thing about it, I mean, for someone who's like as notoriously cheap as I am, is that those, you know, the big, what they call the hubcap artichokes that you use for steaming are really expensive. But the medium-sized and the small ones that they call babies, are really inexpensive. It's a great ingredient. I like to serve the medium artichokes just by themselves as a side dish.
What do you do to them?
You strip them all down. And, you know, people do that by hand, you know, peel back the tough leaves. I learned how to do it from a guy who had worked the brunch shift at Brennan's. Brennan's is one of the most famous brunch restaurants in New Orleans, and it's famous not only for its hurricanes, but it's famous for serving artichoke-based egg dishes, egg sardou and things like that. They must go through as many artichokes in a weekend as most restaurants go through in a year. And I mean, you know, you talk about somebody who's cleaned a lot of artichokes, and there's a really easy way to do it with a knife. It's hard to explain, but basically you're just trimming the outside of it. You're turning the artichoke against the knife and trimming away all of those tough leaves.
Yeah, you have the stem facing towards you.
Right.
And you have to have a good, short, sharp knife,
right.
And you just keep turning it.
Just keep turning it, and all that comes off. And then you cut off about the top third, peel the base, quarter it, pop out the choke if there's any choke there. In fact, with most of the small ones, you won't find a choke at all.
Which is one reason to use them a lot.
Exactly. Another important thing is you need to keep them in acidulated water. You know, keep them in water with lemon juice or vinegar added, because you get enzymatic browning otherwise, and they turn black and kind of funky. And then my favorite way to cook them usually starts with some kind of a braise. Put the artichokes in the pan with olive oil, a couple smashed cloves of garlic, just enough water to kind of lightly coat the bottom of the pan, and cook that over medium heat with a cover on until the artichokes are tender enough that you can pierce them with a knife. At that point, take off the lid, crank up the heat just as hot as you can get it, and cook it, you know, kind of tossing it. And what happens is all of the – I'm getting hungry just talking about it. All of the juice that the artichoke has exuded while it's cooking has mixed with that water and with the olive oil. When the heat comes up, the liquid from that evaporates. And so what you're left with is this unbelievably flavorful glaze that just kind of – it coats the pieces of the artichoke, and you get like artichoke squared. It's just – it's an amazing dish.
It's so good. And what I like to do is what you do, and then throw in some of these tasty little winter from Mexico baby tomatoes.
Oh, yeah.
and maybe a few really nice Moroccan oil-cured olives.
That sounds great.
And do the same thing.
Well, that, it's one of those things. It's not even a recipe. It's like a basic preparation, because from there you can do – like I like to do it also with I'll add some orange zest and orange juice and black olives and more garlic and parsley, red pepper flakes at the very end just to warm it through and flavor it. But you can take it in so many different directions from that. If you play with it however you think it's going to taste good.
Absolutely.
It's also really good at the very end if you toss in some steamed new potatoes.
Ooh, yeah, that's so good.
And just make a great, you know, just a little kind of a casserole-y kind of thing out of it. That, I mean, that'll be dinner some nights for me. That's, I think it's great.
I love that. And also when we're using the little, the baby ones, I'll prep them all, you know, trim them a little bit, cut off the top, trim the base, cut them in half or in quarters. And sometimes I'll just blanch them. And then you can use those in any pasta dish you want, like chicken and artichoke.
Mm-hmm.
You could do risotti. You can use them in lasagna.
I think artichoke risotto is one of those really special dishes, because there's something about it where the artichoke flavor really kind of penetrates the rice in a way that lots of other risottos are nice. You know, like an asparagus risotto is a wonderful spring dish, but it doesn't have the kind of artichoke risotto has this kind of profundity to it.
It's nice to do both.
The flavor really hits both.
It's nice to have both in there. Yeah, a little spring one, like a risotto primavera with leeks, peas. Or what I like to do is sugar snap peas and cut them lengthwise so you get the little peas inside showing.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And then the artichokes and a little bit of asparagus tips.
That sounds wonderful. And, of course, you know it's completely locavore, or well, fairly. But something like 85% of the artichokes that are grown in the United States come from Castroville, which is right up just outside of Monterey. And Marilyn Monroe was the first artichoke queen in Castroville.
Isn't that fabulous? Russ Parsons, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me on.
That was Russ Parsons, food editor and wine columnist of the Los Angeles Times. I love talking to him about food. We've been talking about artichokes. A single artichoke is one of those things that's best eaten alone. It's a small and compact luxury that can make you feel taken care of. Eating alone is a world unto itself. Here's what I do. Take out a delicious fruity popsicle in the evening, sit down on the couch, unpeel the wrapper, and just enjoy that popsicle all by myself. I'm curious what you do when you're eating alone. Do you cook for yourself? Go out to eat at a nice restaurant? Are you a one to just make a bowl of popcorn at home and call it a night? Let me know. Call us at 310-581-5858. That's 310-581-5858. I'll air some of your responses in the next couple of weeks. The grilled cheese sandwich, of course, is another luxury of the solo eater. And since it's National Grilled Cheese Month, who knew? I'm celebrating by asking a few of the cheese grilling masters to give us their favorite way to do it. And Andrew Steiner of Andrew's Cheese Shop on Montana and Santa Monica knows his cheese.
The most important factor of making grilled cheese, which gets neglected the most, is the bread. Everybody screws the bread up. It's very, very important that you don't just stick it in a toaster. You get really kind of dry, leathery, brittle bread when you just use a toaster. You want to get the crust off, because when you cook the crust, that gets really dry and falls all over the place. You want a nice, crisp, but moist feeling to the bread. So there's a couple ways to do it. You take the crust off it and then dry the bread out. We put it in the oven, say like 350 degrees for about 10 minutes till it gets like a light golden brown. We take a clove of garlic and rub it into the bread while the bread is dry, and it really sucks it up. And then we'll moisten the bread with some butter or some oil or something like that. The best melters are the high moisture content cow's milk cheeses like a cheddar. So Montgomery's cheddar, farmhouse traditional cheddar from Somerset, England in the Southwest, is nice and rich and sharp, and it's got like this kind of musty, earthy feel to it. Sometimes we'll put like a little piece of some Black Forest ham on it before we put it in the oven. And that's pretty much my secret grilled cheese recipe. That's no longer secret.
Andrew Steiner runs Andrew's Cheese Shop on Montana Avenue in Santa Monica. I'd love to know your grilled cheese recipe. Comment on our site at kcrw.com/goodfood. You may have noticed that cocktails have blown up lately. A good bar wouldn't be caught dead with that bottled cocktail mix. Food writer Jonathan Gold's with me. When Good Food returns, we'll throw a few back. I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to KCRW and KCRW.com. This morning, our chat with Jonathan Gold, Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer and critic from the LA Weekly, takes a different turn than usual. I think we're going to talk about a little bit of tipples, are we not?
We are indeed. There is a cocktail renaissance going on in the country in general and in Los Angeles at the specific right now. And I think I finally realized it was in full swing at Campanile a couple months ago, where Mark Peel, you know, brought something over. And usually when Mark brings something over, it's like this totally great cured meat he's excited about or this vegetable that he's found. He brought over a drink in a glass. It's like, thanks, Mark. What's that? It's Fish House Punch. And Fish House Punch, of course, is a very old American cocktail invented in a rowing club near Philadelphia. And it's included in the Jerry Thomas's bar book, which is the first bar book written in the United States in like 1861, 1862. It's a very old drink. It was a punch, you know.
And it was good?
It was good.
I like punches.
It's good. I mean, his trick on it was that he used, you know, fresh, wonderful height of season farmers market peaches, which obviously they did not do in 1862. But I was figuring if he was taking this seriously enough, and he's opening another all cocktail restaurant, that it was definitely time to look around. And there's some amazing new cocktail bars in Los Angeles. A place called Seven Grand on 7th near Grand, oddly enough, is a whiskey specialty bar owned by Sed Moses, who owns a lot of the better bars in town at the moment. And they have hundreds of different kinds of whiskey. But they also, instead of just serving whiskey as whiskey, they serve really good old fashions, which is with a sugar cube muddled with bitters and whiskey poured over it and maybe a little bit of fruit. They've got spectacular Sazeracs, which are almost becoming the Los Angeles drink. There are so many Sazeracs.
It's amazing,
Sazeracs
actually.
Now,
for people who have never heard of this oddly named cocktail, talk a little bit about its provenance.
A Sazerac, or Sazerac, I guess it's probably called, is a classic New Orleans cocktail. It started out as, I guess, brandy and absinthe and bitters and a little bit of sugar. It's a real drink. Better now because I think you can get real absinthe, which has that, you know, intense herbal thing going on that's bitter in a way that nobody would have dared before it became legal again. It's this sort of licorice, whiskey, slightly sweet, potent, cold, wonderful thing.
Mm, yum. So share with us some other great cocktails that you've had around town.
Sed Moses owns other bars. He owns the Doheny, which is it's a membership club, and you can sort of get your way in sometimes if you want to, but they occasionally do events with Kogi, the taco truck, where they actually go to Koreatown and they get different cocktails and they put them together, and it has spicy, you know, savory Asian flavors that marry perfectly with the Kogi tacos, except they're drinks on their own within the context of cocktails.
That's incredible. That's so LA. I love that.
There's Cole's, the French dip place downtown, which has become a palace of cocktails. The Cole's bar itself serves classic, like, champagne cocktails and Sazeracs and old fashions. And then in the back of it, through what looks like a broom closet door, is the Varnish. They have a very small cocktail list. It's a very small place. They do everything to order. And for example, one of the really good drinks there is something called Gin and It. It's half gin, half sweet Italian vermouth. Sounds disgusting. in its original warm formulation. Actually, it probably was disgusting, but they found a way to ice it properly and serve it. And it's snappy and it's delicious. They do a Silver Gin Fizz, which is like a version of the Ramos Fizz, a famous New Orleans drink, which is also really good, using egg whites that are separated to order. Some of the other good bars in town, Copa de Oro in Santa Monica, the bartender Vincenzo Marinella started the cocktail program at Providence, which a lot of people think is ground zero for the nouveau cocktail movement in Los Angeles. And when he was Providence, he was famous for using all the sort of molecular gastronomy things in the kitchen in the furtherance of cocktailianism.
That was worth waiting for.
doing sous vide infusions and using a little bit of the industrial thickeners and that sort of stuff. Copa de Oro is more classic, and it's sort of a stump the bartender place. He goes, he gets a lot of produce from the Santa Monica Farmers Market, which is right around the corner. He has a list of cocktails. You pick a list of liquors. You pick a liquor, you pick a couple of farmers market things, and he or one of the people on his staff puts it together, presto changeo. And it's almost always good, and you'll never be able to order it again because it changes every time.
Have fun. I wish I had one now. Thank you so much, Jonathan.
Thank you.
Each week, you can read Jonathan Gold in the LA Weekly. This Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer stops by Good Food nearly every week to share his latest food finds. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood to find out some of Jonathan's past recommendations. One of the best things about this show is the audience who listens to Good Food. I'm talking about you. A few weeks back, one listener living in Poland told me about the Polish habit of eating a second breakfast. More about that and how this listener found herself living in Poland. That's in 1 minute, right here on Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. I love when we get emails from listeners because you never know what story you're going to hear. We got an email from a listener living in Poland telling us about the Polish custom of the second breakfast. So we thought we'd get her on the phone and find out what it's all about. Mara Spurman lives in Warsaw. So what brought you to Poland?
My second daughter went to college and I was left with an empty nest, and my horoscope said I had 3 days to change my life. So I got on the internet and took a job teaching Montessori preschool in Warsaw, Poland, and packed up and left.
Now, I should say that one of the things that intrigued us about the email you sent was the description you gave us of the second breakfast that's served to the children who are at the Montessori school where you work.
At all schools, really, have second breakfast. Children eat a very light cereal breakfast or a piece of toast. But at 10:30, we serve. The parents bring in. Everybody takes a turn. They bring in meats, plural, cheeses, two different vegetables, peppers, cucumbers, of course, pickles, you know, whatever, lettuce, tomatoes. Lots of bread, like a roll or two per child, fruits, raisins, dried nuts, and then a little Actimel drink. And they sit and eat for 35 to 40 minutes.
Now, let's talk a little bit about pork, because when I think about Poles, I think about sausage. So when you go to a supermarket there, what does the sausage aisle look like?
If you walk from the front of a Costco to the very back, that will be refrigerator counters of pork products.
Incredible.
I couldn't believe it myself.
So if they're so in love with pork, does the ham feature importantly on the Easter table as it does here?
No. The people I know think it's like insane to eat hot ham, and they would never think of buying a whole ham. They were just astounded that we would buy a whole ham and serve it. They buy what I could only call are cold cuts of these various regions and make like a cold cut counter, you know, a buffet table full of things. And the idea of glazing a ham, they were like, "What?"
Now, what about their relationship with fresh fruits and vegetables? They're eating so many pork products.
There is no such thing as a salad bar here. Or rather, there's no salad on a salad bar. You can go to a salad bar that looks like a traditional American salad bar, and there will be no lettuce on it. It'll just be sauerkraut, coleslaw, crab, everything you can imagine that can be bound together with mayonnaise or a vinaigrette will be on the table, but there won't be any lettuce leaves.
Okay, so what do you like to eat?
I can't believe the Poles can make such great pasta as they make in these pierogies, these stuffed little dumplings, and stuff them so well and have them so light tasting and have them so available at every little delicatessen. You can just buy 4, 8, 12 of them and eat them anytime you want. And the potato kopitkas, which are the same thing as an Italian gnocchi. I don't think the Italians know how to make them as well. If you taste tested Polish kopitka next to gnocchi, the Poles would win hand down. They are light, perfect, fluffy pillows.
Wow. Thank you so much for sharing your story with us.
Oh, you're welcome.
See some pictures from Mars Berman and her Polish adventure at kcrw.com/goodfood. Anxiety makes us do funny things. Take this financial situation, for example. The constant comparisons to the Great Depression have so many of us wondering how we would fare in that kind of climate. Take my next guest, for example. She and her boyfriend have been eating on $30 a week. How she does it when Good Food continues on KCRW and KCRW.com. With the new economic environment, many of us are settling in for the long haul, making considerable changes in the way we shop and plan meals, even if our personal situations haven't necessarily changed. 30 Bucks a Week is a blog that chronicles the budget eating life of Christina DaCosta and her boyfriend Philip. Christina and Philip live in the Park Slope neighborhood of Brooklyn, New York, which is where she is joining me this morning. What was the original inspiration for your $30 a week grocery bill? Was it just to save money?
No, it was really because we shop at the Park Slope Food Co-op, which is one of the reasons why we're able to do this budget and eat so well. But they switched over from a cash-only system to a debit card system. And I found myself every week just spending more and more money on things that I thought, you know, were delicious and tasty, but they'd kind of just languish in the fridge. And I realized that I needed to just put a dollar amount on the grocery bill and follow it.
What do you think you were spending on average before this?
Probably like 60 bucks a week or more.
Yeah, so double.
Yeah, double definitely.
For people who have never been to a food co-op, could you describe what they are and how they work?
Sure. Well, the Park Slope Food Co-op is unique in that if you want to shop there, you need to be a member there. And the reason why the costs are, you know, lower than even a normal co-op is because everybody who works there, you know, is able to shop there, and they don't have to pay, you know, employees to, you know, man the cash registers, do the receiving, load the groceries onto the shelves. All of the members have to do that work. So instead of, you know, a grocery store markup of 120 to 175%, they only charge, you know, substantially lower, might be just like 25%.
Now, just so we have an idea of your eating habits, are you an omnivore, a vegetarian, a vegan?
Both of us are vegetarians. We eat lots of cheese and eggs, as much as we possibly can do on our budget right now.
So as you started to go on this project, this $30 a week eating, did you find that the way you were shopping and cooking changed dramatically?
I wouldn't say dramatically. More just thinking about what we actually had in the pantry or in the fridge and coming up with creative, delicious things to do with our food. One of the reasons why we spent so much money before was, you know, we'd be in the house and we'd be getting dinner ready and think, oh, I really want some fajitas tonight. So we would go out and we would buy stuff to make fajitas because we had this craving. And now I find, you know, if we have that kind of craving, we just find another way to deal with it and find another dinner that will incorporate some of those flavors, but will allow us to use what we actually have in the house.
So instead of being recipe or dish driven, you're ingredient driven.
Yeah, precisely. We didn't have any flour or eggs really left by the end of this week, and I really wanted to make some pancakes. So I just kind of created a monster pancake out of rice flour, the small amount of wheat flour we had left, some oats, a dash of corn flour, and like a flaxseed egg replacer because I had flaxseeds in the fridge. So, and they came out really good. They were super hearty. They went well with the pear compote I made. So it's kind of just take whatever you have and just see what you can do with it.
I love what you did with the liquid in that recipe.
Oh, the bourbon?
Yeah.
Yeah. I didn't finish the bourbon, my glass of bourbon the night before. I stuck it in the fridge and thought, ooh, this could be good. Why not?
Did you as a couple have a reputation for entertaining a lot before, and do you still entertain?
Yeah. Phil and I, we definitely like to have people in our apartment. And, you know, we still have dinner parties, and we still like to cook impressively for our friends. You know, but it's different. It's different things. Like now we might ask people to bring a dessert, whereas before I would be like, oh, let me make, you know, homemade ice cream with a pie and all this crazy stuff. But, you know, it's also learning to let go a little bit and letting other people carry some of the burden. You don't have to do it all by yourself.
One of the most interesting parts of your blog is that you actually scan in your receipts so people can look at the receipts and see how much everything costs. And I have to say that sometimes I look at those receipts and I'm like, just wow, this food is like free. Do you rely on the bulk bins a lot at the co-op? And also, do you occasionally supplement from ethnic markets?
Yeah, oh, definitely. Bulk is your friend if you are shopping on a budget or you're trying to be frugal. We definitely use the bulk bins. You know, we get our flour, we get our oats, we get salt, we get sugar. But I mean, I also love shopping in Chinatown.
Christina, it's really been a pleasure talking to you, and I just want to tell you how much I enjoy your blog.
Thanks, Evan. I'm so glad, and you know, I'm a big fan of good food, so this is very exciting.
Christina DaCosta blogs about her $30 a week life. Read it at kcrw.com/goodfood. Of course, anxiety also tends to make chocolate look a lot more attractive. Maybe that's why the chocolate business seems to be flourishing. I'll be right back to taste chocolate mixed with spice, fruits, and all kinds of things. You're listening to Good Food. I'm Evan Kleiman, your host, and we're here together on KCRW and kcrw.com. Thank you. Are you in the mood for something a little tropical? Mix in some chocolate and we are near perfection. Nat Bletter is an ethnobotanist who combines some incredible and unlikely flavors in his chocolate bars. When we last talked with him, he was foraging in Central Park. Now he's in Hawaii, still foraging, but this time for tropical fruits and cacao. So, Nat, tell us a little bit about your chocolate bars. This is the new thing you're doing.
Yeah, but it does bring in a lot of the foraging that I talked about when I was on last time, because we're actually trying to incorporate a lot of wild and sometimes invasive plants into the chocolate that are both delicious and really good for you. Like, I don't know if you've heard of autumnberry or silverberry, but this is a plant that's all over the Northeast. It happens to have 17 times the lycopene of tomatoes.
And like lycopene in tomatoes, do the berries need to be cooked down to make that available?
Exactly. You got it. So in some cases with something like tomatoes or the silverberries, you want to cook them to make the antioxidants more available. However, it's the opposite with chocolate, that when you a normal part of making chocolate, it's a very lengthy process that some people might not be familiar with. You have to roast them as one of the stages. And that roasting, turns out, destroys about 75% of the antioxidants in the chocolate. So we're trying to figure out how to make the chocolate unroasted, but still safe and still taste really good, because a lot of times if you don't roast it, you lose out on a lot of those tasty Maillard reactions that go on when you cook something.
And also the fermentation. I mean, the fermentation also gives you a lot of those really just amazing myriad of like a cascade of aroma and flavor.
Exactly. Yeah, the fermentation is the first step in the process, and that usually happens when the pods are picked right off the tree. It's put under banana leaves and fermented for a few days. And if you try to make chocolate from unfermented cacao, it's just completely, completely inedible.
Now, let's go back to the idea of using the chocolate raw rather than roasted, the cacao. What is the difference in flavor and texture? Are you able to conch the chocolate to make it really smooth with raw cacao?
Yeah, it is definitely more bitter and more astringent and more acidic when it's not roasted. So there's two ways that we work around that. One is to add all these interesting flavors that sort of complement it. So that's why we use predominantly fruity flavors like the acai and the passion fruit, and we're working on a red wine flavored chocolate too, or infused, I should say. So those sort of tangy flavors work really well with the raw chocolate, but you can still conch it, as you said. We have to do probably a little longer than you would with normal chocolate for several days, it turns out, but that sort of takes the place of the roasting and developing the flavors. And so once it comes out of the conching, it's got more of that rich flavor, and it's sort of lost a little bit of the astringency that makes people not want to eat it. But the great thing is that if we do it right, and by understanding the whole process of heating and grinding that goes on from harvesting the bean through fermentation and conching, we can make a bar of chocolate that has up to four times the antioxidants of a regular roasted bar of chocolate.
When someone first tastes your chocolate, do they notice that there's something quite different about it?
Yeah, a lot of people say it's the only refreshing chocolate that they've ever had. So normally chocolate is very rich and sort of coats your whole mouth, and that I love roasted chocolate as well. But this raw chocolate sort of leaves you feeling refreshed, and like just that tanginess, it's almost thirst quenching, which is hard to imagine from a chocolate bar.
And the mouthfeel, so does it not coat? Does it not have that sort of ultimate chocolate, sort of indulgence feeling of that melting that happens?
No, it does. They're the same fats in there. The cocoa butter is still in there and still really rich, but it's just the tanginess sort of, I don't know, gets your salivary glands going and makes you feel like you've just had a really fresh drink.
Thank you so much.
Of course. Thank you for having me, Evan.
Nat Bletter blogged for us from the Kona Chocolate Festival. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood to find our blog and read about the world of chocolate. A lot of vegetarians say they won't eat anything that has a face. Well, what about eating something that is a face? Deep End Diner Eddie Lin reports from the front lines of hardcore eating. Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. We'll be right back. With times as hard as they are right now, one starts to think about making a meal out of nothing, really trying to eat so parsimoniously that you don't have to spend a lot of money. So, of course, my head turned towards Eddie Lin, our Deep End Diner, who blogs about unusual eating, let's say. I think he may have found a real recession buster. Hi, Eddie.
Hey, Evan. You know, I think I'm going to have to rename my website Cheap End Dining pretty soon, you know. You know, this is one of those times when I'm actually kind of happy to do what I do because a lot of the stuff I go for is traditionally, you know, from the peasant food tradition.
It's more than peasant food. It's from peasant food tradition, from cuisines, from parts of the world where people are just intensely frugal.
Right. But sometimes out of necessity.
Absolutely.
You know, and that's kind of where we are today. But what, you know, how I found this roasted pig face, which is the topic.
I love that. How I found this roasted pig face.
You know, really, it started off as a joke. You know, one of my favorite Chinese Hong Kong-style barbecue places is Sam Wu's. And they have several locations throughout L.A., you know, when you walk into one of these Chinese barbecues, they have this display, right, where they, you know, have ducks, you know, racked by their necks, you know, just hanging there. And, you know, the side of a roast pig just hanging there next to the ducks. Well, at the bottom of this display are, like, you know, severed duck heads and their necks. And occasionally there'll be half of a pig's face.
Now, a pig's face, not the head, the face.
The face, exactly. So it's basically just halved, you know, down the center through the snout and everything. And I saw this roasted pig's face lying there, and, you know, I was just kind of joking to the counter guy. And I asked him if it was for sale, and he goes, oh, yeah, you know, $1.50, you know.
$1.50 for a pig's face.
$1.50.
That's a lot of meat.
It is. I mean, I never ate a pig's face before until that day. And so I'm like, you know, yeah, why not, you know?
How did you approach the pig's face? Knife and fork?
Oh, no. It's like, imagine eating a rib, you know, pork ribs, but it happens to be, you know, shaped like a pig's face. Because you just got to grab it, and it's not a pretty, you know, sight. It's totally, you know, grab it by your hands and gnaw on it. But the thing is about pig's face is that it's kind of a self-contained meal. You have built-in appetizers. You know, the pig's ears, or ear, because you only get one, is really crispy. It's almost like a chicharrones, you know, kind of texture. Really crunchy, greasy, you know, and really just excellent. You know, just a great starter. And then, you know, the eyeball is kind of there. It's kind of been roasted you know, pretty well. But, you know, in some cultures, it's you know, you present it to the guest of honor.
Now, is the eyeball, once it's been roasted that much, is it still kind of custardy, or is it more like an egg yolk?
Well, if you're lucky, it's still kind of custardy. But mine was really dried out, so there really wasn't much left to it. But, oh my God, I'll tell you what's not dried out is the cheek.
The cheeks.
The snout even, you know. And it's just really tender. And the skin that covers the meat, the cheek meat, is wonderfully crisp. And
like shatteringly crisp.
Yes. It's just amazing. It's so underrated, you know, this
part. Well, it's really funny because, you know, in Italy, a lot, you know, you have pancetta, which, of course, is the cured belly meat.
Mm-hmm.
It's the salted belly meat. But then you also have guanciale, which is the cheek. And mm-hmm. that's much more highly prized.
Yes. And there's a Filipino dish called sisig. And that's a combination of pork belly chopped and... it's really rare to find it with pig face, but traditionally there's pig face involved too, and it's kind of a stew.
So is this a dish at Samu's that a lot of people ask for, or is it sort of like a secret?
Well, it's enough that they have a price tag for it. You know, they weren't guessing how much to charge me, so you know, that just makes me think that I wasn't the first one. You know, for sure, but. I'm guessing the quantity is limited.
yeah, because, I mean, how many are they going to have in a day?
Exactly. But, you know, at $1.50, you know, they're going to fly out. And it would be 75 cents per person if you
That's really unbelievable.
That's exactly.
Great. And then if you take it home, you could cook with the remains.
You could cook with it. Right.
You could, like, throw it into broth or stew.
Well, I'm telling you, that's why I'm telling – you know, this is the great secret. We need this kind of stuff right now. Everything's so expensive, you know, and, you know, everyone's losing
face,
their jobs.
Some rice and some beans, and there you
Absolutely.
Are.
Absolutely. You know, and, you know, get used to it. You know, forget your pork loins and pork chops and ribs. You know, get used to pig face and you know, pork feet and offals. Let them eat pig face. That's what's going to happen pretty soon.
Tell us where Samu's is.
Samu's is in several locations around L.A., but the one I went to is in the Valley, in Van Nuys, on Sepulveda Boulevard and Victory.
Terrific. Eddie Lin is the Deep End Diner. Find his latest posts on eating crazy stuff in L.A. at kcrw.com/goodfood. And you can see Eddie on the latest Good Food video podcast. Find it at kcrw.com/goodfood. Be my Facebook fan. Add me, Evan Kleinman, to your profile. Also, did you know that you can embed this show on your blog or webpage? Go to kcrw.com/goodfood and click listen. You can sign up for the Good Food newsletter, too. I've got a recipe for you to try and book giveaways every week. Good Food's executive producer is Jennifer Farrow. The show's produced by Harriet Ells, Bob Carlson, Holly Tarson, Connie Alvarez, Candace Moyer, Jillian Ferguson, and Steve Billings. Gary Messiha is our music supervisor. See you next week for another edition of Good Food.